Welcome to Your Life Reset, a Virta Health podcast series. I'm your host, Teresa Link, and in this series, we'll hear from people on their Virta journey, the wins, failures, moments of adversity, and moments of joy they're experiencing along the way. So sit back, relax, and listen as we unwrap the truly human experience of Virta. Hey there, listeners. I'm Teresa Link, dietitian and content creator at Virta, and this is Your Life Reset. Managing type 1 diabetes is extremely challenging. Keeping blood sugar in a safe range can feel like a constant battle. From life-threatening diabetic ketoacidosis and hypoglycemia to longer-term risks like heart disease, kidney disease, nerve damage, and vision loss, the complications are serious. But what if there was another way? Today's guest, Kes O'Connelly, has taken control of her type 1 diabetes by changing her diet. She's not just living, but thriving on a low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic lifestyle. And she's here today to share how it's transformed her health. So could a ketogenic diet be a game changer for type 1 diabetes? Let's find out. All right, well, Kes, welcome to the show. I'm so excited that you're here.
So happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, again, I am so excited to dive into this topic with you. But before we do, I want our listeners just to get to know you a little bit, who they're talking to today or who they're listening to today. So tell us about yourself. You know, how old were you when you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes? And you know, what was that like?
Well, I was 2.5, so I don't remember what it was like. But my father was in a nursing program and they were studying diabetes. And he noticed that his 2-year-old had all the symptoms, like peeing a lot and just unquenchable thirst. And he brought me to the hospital. And the story goes that the doctor said, oh, no, she's too young. It's not possible that she would have diabetes. And I'm pretty sure my dad raised his fist to the guy and said, you're going to test my kid. And thank God he did, because my blood sugar was 600. When I was diagnosed.
Oh my goodness.
Which is actually low for like little kids who are first diagnosed. They're usually over 1,000.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So it was actually very, very lucky. But a lot of kids are sent home with the flu and they go home and fall into a coma and die. And it's awful.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I was very, very lucky that my dad just noticed it and fought for me and they got the diagnosis.
Yeah. So really, it's all you've known.
Yeah. I don't know another life.
Do you have, you know, does your dad ever talk about, you know, what it was like in those, you know, those early months, early years?
I mean, I heard a lot of stories growing up, and I know that I had 13 seizures the first year after I was diagnosed until I was able to kind of go, oh, I feel funny, you know, because at 2.5, it's like, the whole I feel low thing wasn't quite there yet. So had a lot of seizures, few ambulance rides until I was able to notice the feeling of what being low felt like and I could say something.
Do you remember about how old you were when you started to be able to recognize some of those, you know, kind of those alarms that might have gone off?
I would guess maybe probably about 4. Maybe younger. I mean, I know those seizures happened in the first year, so 2.5 to 3.5. So I'm guessing that would probably be about right. Around 3.5 was probably when I was starting to go, something's not right, before I went into a severe low blood sugar.
Yeah. I mean, that's, again, it's all you've known. But for your loved ones around you, for those, your parents, your family members, friends, you know, that's so terrifying for them to see their 2.5, 3.5, 4-year-old daughter, you know, going through this. And how scary it was for them, I have no doubt. And yet for you, really, you haven't known really anything different. Again, this is just how things have always been.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, as you were growing up, what sort of modifications did you make for yourself, or did you have family that made for you, you know, in school or in any sort of social events, sporting events? What sort of things did you have to do to really make sure that you were safe?
So, I mean, management for type 1 is completely different now. Like, we didn't have sensors. It was just, I was on 3 shots a day and 3 blood sugars a day. And that was it until I went to college. So as far as modifications went, you know, I don't even remember. I mean, obviously my teachers knew, like, when I was little, but I think I didn't even have like a blood sugar meter at school with me. So,
oh, wow.
So things like, if I felt low, I mean, that's all it would be was, oh, I feel low. And then I'd have some glucose tablets in my backpack with me, or the teacher might have like a juice box. But I don't think we ever even had like a meter at school with me, which is wild to think about today. Like,
it really is. It really is. I mean, so you were kind of just taking a shot in the dark based on what you felt.
Yeah, but also the insulins were very different. So, you know, rapid acting insulins, like super rapid acting, Humalog, Novolog, Apidra, these guys, they didn't come out, like, they weren't available till I was in high school. So I'm going to take a stab, like, 96-ish. And
okay.
They still didn't really know how to use them. Like, there was no carb counting. That wasn't like a thing quite yet until a few years later. So the slower acting insulins that I was on, the regular and NPH, was the jam until college, really. And so they're on some level, they're more forgiving. So I wouldn't have those like severe lows with them, but I was running high, but it didn't have these extreme highs and lows that come with rapid acting insulins.
Gotcha. A little bit more.
Yeah.
A little bit more wiggle room for some of those variations, it seems like.
Well, as far as sending your 7-year-old to school who might have a low blood sugar, like, the lows weren't, I mean, it's tricky, right? Because it's diabetes. So we're constantly thinking highs and lows. But with those less strong insulins, the sharp peaks and valleys didn't really exist in the same way that they do today. That's a better
gotcha.
Way to say it.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I'm really interested to kind of hearing about how your therapy has changed and what that looks like today versus when you were a kid. Before we get there, can you tell our audience a little bit more about type 1 diabetes? How is it different from type 2 diabetes?
So the main difference is that type 1 is autoimmune. So it means the body's attacking itself. So for some reason, and I don't think science has answered this question yet, but the white blood cells attack the insulin-producing cells of the pancreas. And so now that person is dependent on exogenous insulin to stay alive.
Exogenous. So, what does that mean?
Outside the body.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So
instead
the body
of my pancreas,
is not making...
Right. Yeah.
So your pancreas is making 0 insulin to help regulate blood sugars on its own. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when they talk about like searching for it, this is kind of off. It's a derailment a little bit. When they talk about like a cure for type 1, it's really 2 things, because one is, we need the cells to be making the insulin. But if you solve that problem, we still haven't solved the problem of the white blood cells attacking those cells that are
okay.
destroying the insulin producing cells. So that's why type 1 in particular is a pretty complex problem to solve, because they have kind of come up with solutions for part of it, but not the whole picture yet.
Understandable. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then so with type 2 diabetes, I think it would be helpful for a lot of our listeners to kind of understand how that is different.
I mean, type 2, it is also there can be a genetic component. I mean, we know that people are more likely to get type 2 if they have family members with it or parents with it. And I guess the general consensus is that it's highly lifestyle driven. And there's an onslaught of glucose coming in. And so what insulin does is it takes the glucose and it puts it into cells. And so when there's that onslaught of glucose, it can't, the insulin just can't manage it effectively enough. And so it kind of wears out those cells and it makes it harder and harder for them to produce insulin. So type 2 can be reversed completely, whereas type 1 can't, because we haven't solved the problem of the body attacking itself.
Gotcha. So allow me to recap in terms that maybe are easily understandable for the vast majority of us, I think, that are listening to this podcast. So with type 2 diabetes, the body produces insulin, at least for a while, but the body's not able to utilize it effectively. And with type 1, the body's not producing insulin. And of course, there are far more complexities to that. But I think that a lot of folks do kind of misunderstand the difference between those two and perhaps what the treatment regimens might be, in particular, diet and lifestyle. Okay, so Kes, I know that I want to talk to you about what you're doing today, how you changed your diet, your lifestyle, your treatment regimen. But I do want to go back in time a little bit more. You know, it was the 80s. You were a kid. You were probably wanting to participate in things like Halloween and probably lots of other, you know, holidays. There's tons of sugar. So what was that like for you?
I actually have a really great Halloween story. So when I was probably maybe 4 or 5, my dad wanted to dress me up for Halloween, and he dressed me up as an insulin bottle.
That is
complete
so great.
Complete with a hula hoop to make the bottle shape, and like a white sheet and like a tinfoil hat. Oh, yes. That's a true story. And like took Sharpie and made like a big R for R100 insulin on the front.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm like, I think I was probably like 5, and my sister's 5 years older than me. So we're going around trick or treating. And more than one person was like, oh, you're such a cute trash can.
I was going to say, could people figure it out? Probably not. Again, it was the 80s.
No. So I was like, I'm not, you know, 5-year-old. I'm not a trash can. I'm an insulin bottle. Oh, what's that? And then I'd give them the PSA on, I have type 1 diabetes and this is what it means. And I have to take insulin. And
you know, actually, it's a way to advocate for yourself.
Sure.
Maybe 5 years old, you don't feel like that so much.
I probably would have preferred to be like a cat, you know, or something. But but it makes for a great story today. But no, we would get home and my sister would get all of my candy and my dad would give me $20. And so I got the money and she got the sugar.
Okay. I feel like that's a song lyric. I got the money, she got the sugar. Did you get to go as a cat?
I probably went as a cat at some point. I don't know. Later on, like I remember in high school, I learned that. So in high school, they started, my doctors at Stanford, I went to Stanford Children's Hospital, and they started talking about carbohydrates. It was the first time I had ever heard carbohydrates. And I remember looking at a bottle of milk, you know, like, and I'm like, okay, I put milk in my cereal and that doesn't have sugar in it. So that's fine. And it said, I don't remember, 12 grams of carbohydrate or whatever. And I thought, oh, well, I can have 2 glasses of milk and nobody gives me a hard time about it. So cool. That's 24 grams of carbohydrate. And then I discovered that, a candy bar, like half of a candy bar would have the 24 grams of carbs. So I was like, I can eat candy every day. So this is my this is my great discovery as a teenager. How does this relate to Halloween? I think so. Then as a teen, I would go, oh yeah, you know, I could have this much or that much and think of it in terms of how many glasses of milk it was, which of course didn't work, but
right. it is some solid, you know, strategizing, problem solving, trying to figure out how to make things work, which could, you know, perhaps not the best lifestyle to just, well, eat all the candy and it's the same as however many glasses of milk, right? But as an adult, some valuable insights that you can learn about making the best possible choices based on carbohydrates. Who knows? I'm just trying to put a silver lining to you eating a bunch of candy. Okay, so thanks for giving us some of those stories and some of that insight. I think that, you know, some listeners out there that maybe have type 1 diabetes themselves, or they have a friend or family member with type 1 diabetes, probably feel fairly isolated, and or at some point in their lives, they felt really isolated. So I imagine it might be helpful for them to hear some of these stories from a friendly face like you. So thanks for sharing.
Well, I was just going to make the comment that something I've noticed really recently, like when I was growing up, like I had no idea if anyone else had diabetes because we didn't have pumps and we didn't have sensors. And I just always thought, well, I'm the only one with diabetes in this grocery store, or I'm the only one with diabetes at the fairgrounds or wherever I was. And now there's something really cool about being like at Costco and seeing somebody with a Dexcom on their arm. It's like, hey, you know, or I'll see people with Omnipods on, and or I'll see insulin pump tubing. And it's like, it's a new world, because that there's part of me in the back of my mind, like, yeah, I'm really not the only one who's dealing with this thing.
Yeah. And that can make really all the difference. Yeah. Regardless of the disease, knowing, hey, I'm not alone in this. There is support. There are other people that are going through this, whether it's type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, various other, you know, diseases.
Right.
So, yeah, I can imagine seeing others and, hey, you know what? We're kind of in the same club.
Totally. Yeah, we call it seeing diabetics in the wild.
Seeing diabetics in the wild. Yeah. It's like when you see your teacher at Target and you're just like, oh, gosh. You exist.
You're a real
outside
person?
The classroom. You're real. Okay. So Cass, as an adult, have found a different way of managing your type 1 diabetes. Tell me about that and how you first kind of came to changing your diet and lifestyle.
Oh, yeah, it was just tremendous luck. I mean, in so many ways. And also, I was just ready for it. But I was on a weight loss journey. And there's a tidbit for you that people with type 1 are more obese than our non-diabetic counterparts. And so, insulin is a fat storage hormone. And so the current standard of care says eat whatever you want, just give insulin for it. And so that is a recipe for obesity, because I can have my bagel and the cake and the pasta, but I actually it's been so long since I've had any of those things, I couldn't tell you, but if I was going to eat a bagel right now, I'd probably need more than 10 units of insulin. That's just a wild guess. Whereas for my eggs and coffee in the morning, I take one unit of insulin. So it's just a tremendous amount of insulin. So what that ultimately means is being very overweight. So I was on this weight loss journey. It was 2016. A friend of mine said, "Have you heard of this program called Brightline Eating?" And I had not. And I researched it, and Brightline Eating is this very, very cool program. It's based off of the principles in Overeaters Anonymous. And so a lot of it talks about how the addictive properties of glucose in the brain, and things like glucose lights up the same parts of the brain as cocaine does and things like that. So it was a very regimented program. And the idea is that you have a bright line. So like a bright line for me is I'm not a smoker. That's a bright line. It's a line I do not cross. I'm not a smoker. So bright line eating is I eat this and only this, and I do not cross that line. And so what I did, I just kind of took the opportunity to say, well, I'm just going to cut out. There's a whole grains portion to their program. And I thought, well, what would happen if I just cut out the grains part of that? And so I ended up doing a ketogenic diet that I didn't really know about. And I was thinking about it. And so I wrote into the nutritionist on staff and I said, so I'm doing bright light eating. I have type 1 diabetes. Do you know if low carb is like something that people do? And can I do this? And what do you think? And how do I make this work? And she didn't really know, but she's like, well, there's this other group called Keto Gains, and it's like a fitness group, but there's somebody there who knows about what you're talking about. So I just kind of followed the breadcrumbs and I went on to Keto Gains and I joined the Facebook group and I just sent a blanket message out like, I have type 1 diabetes. I heard you guys are the people. Like, is this a thing? And I got a private message back from a guy whose son is type 1 and he's a researcher. And he was like, yeah, we've been doing this for my kiddo. He's had non-diabetic A1Cs in the fours. And I was like, that can't be right. That just can't be right. He's like, yeah, I need you to join our Facebook group, Type 1 Grit. So again, I'm following the breadcrumb trail. And at that point on Type 1 Grit, I learned about Dr. Richard Bernstein, who wrote Diabetes Solution. He's a physician in New York City, still practicing in his late 80s and has type 1 himself and no complications. And it just blew my mind because my entire life I was told, look, you're never going to have a non-diabetic A1C. Like the best you can hope for is 7. 7 is the goal. And these guys, adults and children, A1Cs in the 4s and 5s. So I was like, all right. But beyond that, I didn't have a lot of guidance. So yes, when I started this, I mean, I had blood sugars going from 40 to 400 because I didn't know how to manage that transition into low carb being on so much insulin because I was eating bagels and pasta every day.
Yeah. It can be quite dangerous, right?
Yeah.
When you, for anyone who's taking insulin to stop eating carbohydrates rather abruptly, because the dangers of those extremely low blood sugars, or just blood sugars that kind of going all over the place, you're trying to chase them. So I'm very grateful for this person, this nutritionist that you asked about, that you asked for help, that she could have just said, no, that's not safe. Or no, I don't know anything about it. I would just continue on the path that you're doing. Instead, she guided you toward other resources that were out there. And like you said, you followed the breadcrumbs, the low carb breadcrumbs. I'm just gonna throw that in there. And you found a group. You found a group where you could find the support that you needed. And probably every single person that I know that has type 1 diabetes. That has type 1 diabetes, who is using at least some form of a low carb diet, is aware of type 1 grit, and has found that success and that help in type 1 grit. So tell me more about this transition into low carb. What that looked like, how the type of support that you got from this group.
Well, the support came in. Bits. I mean, because it's a Facebook group and there's a lot of people, and you know, I didn't really quite know. I was figuring it out, and I don't know that I had any like really clear direct guidance from the beginning. So it was a lot of trial and error. I expected that, okay, I'm not eating a bagel, so I won't need, you know, obviously that insulin is going to come down. I don't need to take insulin for something I'm not eating. What I did not anticipate was that my basal insulin would decrease. So for those who don't know, type 1 is generally treated with a long acting insulin and a short acting insulin. So we all need insulin all the time, whether or not you're eating. So your body always needs that insulin. And then if there's glucose being consumed, you then need insulin to cover that. So the idea is there's a long acting insulin covering the constant needs of the liver's giving glucose. Go way
just
deep
like
into
your body
the
functioning,
stuff.
Right?
Yes.
You need some you need low level insulin just to manage your body functioning, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
For the most part.
But then if you're eating an apple, your body needs to give you insulin for that apple. So for people on pumps, it's just one type of insulin, but you're getting a little bit all the time, and that's called your basal rate. And then you would give more for the food that you eat, or the glucose that you're consuming.
So you kind of figured this out on your own through some trial and error, right? Okay.
Yeah.
How involved was your doctor in this conversation?
Nil.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Definitely not something we're advocating for.
Yeah.
So if you are listening and you have type 1 diabetes, definitely a good idea to ensure that your doctor knows what's going on so that the two of you can work together and make sure you come up with a plan. That said, you really understanding your body, having this for so long, knowing how different foods affect your blood sugar, being able to make those little tweaks a little bit at a time and kind of figure out how much insulin that you needed, was definitely an advantage for you, it sounds like, as you were making this change.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would have been nice to have guidance, like, from a doctor. I think a lot of, we have to remember that there's a standard of care and there's a certain type of education that doctors go through. And so, I mean, I was very, very lucky that my doctor at the time, he wasn't involved in helping me make dietary changes or changing my insulin. That was really all on me. But I would come in and, when I hit an A1C of 7, I had never seen that in my life. By that time, I'd had diabetes for 32 years already. And then I hit the 6.5 and I was like, oh my God. I mean, and he's giving me a big hug and, getting it down under 6 was, it was a celebration.
Heck yeah. How has your quality of life changed since you made this adjustment to your diet, this major, major adjustment to your diet and lifestyle?
I have tears in my eyes when you ask that question. And my life, I was told at one point that I would go blind within a year because I had diabetic retinopathy that was so profound. I was in the emergency room 4 or 5 times a year because I couldn't stop throwing up from gastroparesis, which is nerve damage to the nerves in the stomach, basically. Every single visit with my doctor was, what's the next thing they're going to tell me that's going to go wrong with my body? And then just the day-to-day constant brain fog, or my blood sugar goes super low and now I've got to like eat everything that isn't nailed down. And then suddenly I'm 500 and now I've got to give a ton of insulin to manage that. And all the time I'm gaining more and more weight and can't think well. And my memory is like, it's hard to think of words and it's hard to learn. And then nobody talks about this one, but just being grouchy all the time. Like, high blood sugars make you grouchy. You just don't, it's like just being kind of low level sick for a really long, long, long time. It's just kind of grumpy. So how has my life changed? How do I ever answer that? Like, now I go to my doctor, I'm like, all right, show me the blood work. Let's go. I expect to live a long time. I expect to have fully functioning kidneys for the rest of my life. I expect to have my feet and my eyes working. I expect to have a strong beating heart. I don't live in fear. I just don't. And I would never trade a bagel for that ever again.
Thank you so much for sharing that story and getting really, you know, really personal with us, because it's very clear how dramatically this has changed your life. And, you know, looking back to see all those things that kind of fell into place that allowed you to get here, those people that maybe stretch out their hand to help you find different resources, and then the flood of people around you that were also going through something too. There are some folks out there that have some serious concerns about maybe trying a low carbohydrate or ketogenic approach with type 1 diabetes. Have people approached you with those concerns or asked you those questions? And, you know, what have you been able to tell them about that?
Sure. I think probably the biggest concern with type 1 is, you know, how do I manage dropping carbohydrates and then manage my insulin? Because I'm on this much insulin. So what do I do? And I think that's the place where we really, really need physicians who can help guide people in that area. Because I didn't have that guidance. And so, yeah, I did the 40 to 400 thing a handful of times in a couple of weeks. And I could do it because I had had diabetes for 30 years at that point. But it sucks and it's hard. So I think that's probably the biggest concern, is just how to stay, how to not put yourself in a really dangerous position. And I guess CGMs are really great in helping with managing that too, because you can see right away kind of what's happening. Yeah, and I think the other thing, which isn't only for type 1s, but a lot of people go, oh, low carb, you know, my gosh, that's, I miss bread. I need to have my bread. And so I think there's the thing I really learned actually from Bright Line Eating was glucose lights up the same parts of the brain as cocaine does. And so, you know, it doesn't mean that we're all addicts, but I think we need to treat it as an addictive substance and understand that in so many diets, they'll say, have it in moderation. Just have a little bit every day. Have a cheat day. You're good. But, you know, if you had a friend who had a serious addiction with a harder substance, you wouldn't say that to them. You'd be like, dude, stop it. Just stop it. So I think that was a huge turning point for me. And so that's something I really, really strive to teach people about, because that initial fear of like, oh my God, you're going to take away my bread. What am I going to do? What am I going to eat? It's like, okay, that's just your brain telling you that you're taking my drugs away, because we are. But then once you get through it, if you stop giving those excuses of, I'll just have a little, half a piece of sourdough bread in the morning, give yourself like 2-3 days of actually not having anything. And just like the illicit substances, you'll feel that sense of relief of, oh, brain fog is lifted. I'm sleeping better. The cravings they're not gone, but they're mostly gone, and it's fine. I'm fine. And then you get to eat bacon.
Heck yeah. And then you get to experience those massive quality of life changes that you described. It's like you don't allow yourself. You may not allow yourself to know the joy of being able to live that way if you don't allow yourself to take that leap. How you would talk to a friend who had a health issue and just say, oh, a little bit in moderation. You know, you could say the same thing about celiac disease. Oh, a little bit of gluten's probably okay. And it's not. It's not okay. It's not okay. And so respecting other people's boundaries and you having an opportunity to educate others, I think, is really great. Just like your insulin costume. Just doing it a little differently maybe these days. Although, who knows? Maybe you want to bring that back.
I don't know. It could happen. But the other thing and I wanted to share is I feel very fortunate. I've had far too many friends before the age of 30 die of cancer. And I think with something like cancer, our modern medicine says, here, you can take this thing and it might work and it might not. Good luck. And that's your only option. And I feel like, God, I got diabetes, you know, of all the things that could have happened to this body, I got a disease that I have actually quite a lot of control over. And so, you know, I can spend my time in this life going, oh, I miss bagels and I want my pancakes. And I mean, of course I want that stuff. I love that stuff. Like, I mean, that's real. But I'm finding that especially, so in December, I celebrated 40 years I do a celebration every year of my diabetes diagnosis anniversary. And so, I mean, with this length of time, I look at it and I go, how lucky am I that I can just, my choice is I don't eat carbs and I get to live a healthy, long life with fully functioning organs. And like, really? That's it? That's the deal. That's the trade-off. Like, okay. Okay. You got it.
It's a wonderful way to look at it. Yeah. It's a very uplifting way to look at it. What you can be gracious for, what you can have, what you gain from this versus focusing on what it is that you don't get to have. Also recognizing it's okay to miss that stuff. Fine.
Yeah.
But what it is that you're giving up? What is it that you get to gain in return? And maintaining that sense of balance is, that's what I'm hearing from you. What advice would you have for someone who has type 1 diabetes themselves or has a family member with type 1 diabetes? And they're curious about changing their lifestyle to include a more ketogenic way of eating. Where might you direct them to start?
I mean, Dr. Bernstein's book is by far, it is the resource for step-by-step instructions. So I think that's a place to start. Keto Gains is an excellent group, lots of type ones on there. So like if someone's really into fitness and they want to kind of blend those, that's a great resource. Type 1 Grit on Facebook is fantastic. Tons of knowledge, tons of resources there. That's the advice is find the people who are doing it and get the step-by-step there. I mean, I wish that there were, I think that we're going to see this in our lifetimes. There will be a paradigm shift with type 1. And when that happens, it'll be really, really cool to be able to go to your physician and say, or actually have your physician come to you and say, here's another option and give you the choice.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that would be really an amazing thing to see.
I think we'll see it. I really hope we'll see it.
I hope so. Especially for like little kids being diagnosed. Like it's just, it's sad to hear that they're being diagnosed and they're in the hospital and they're being fed pancakes and told your body doesn't make the substance that's required to manage this food, but you should eat this food.
Yeah.
And anyway, there's a whole other trail, but
a whole other podcast episode.
Yeah, there you go.
Gotcha. Yeah, gotcha. Well, Cass, it was really a joy to get to chat with you about this today, get here from your perspective as a real person who is managing this very complicated disease, how you've been able to completely change the quality of your life, what you had to give up, but what you got to gain in return, and most importantly, getting to have the rest of your life ahead of you, living that in a healthy way. It's hard to ask for anything more than that. So thanks again so much for being on today. And we can dive into some other topics in a future podcast.
That sounds awesome. Thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been great to talk about it and, it's really nice and it's clarifying to like talk about these things and like hear like, oh yeah, like that's a milestone. That's a thing that's happening. That's a new way that my life is that I don't often get to reflect on. So I appreciate you inviting me and having this conversation.
Yeah, of course. I'm glad you got to reflect. Thanks again, Cass.
Thanks.
If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. And if you'd like to regain control of your metabolic health and feel like yourself again, check us out at virta.com. That's VIRTA.com. Your Life Reset is for informational purposes only and shouldn't be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Contact your provider if you suspect you have a medical problem. I'll chat with you all again soon. Until then, stay inspired, my friends.